Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I mean, veganism gets a reputation for being exclusive, but really, barring allergies, anybody can eat it, and it should be very welcoming, so that's my attitude about it.
Joshua Plug travels around the country cooking pay-what-you-can vegan feasts in people's homes. Come with us to one of his pop-up dinner parties today. Harvest Public Media looks at why researchers are modifying Monsanto's genetically engineered soybean. Then it's Daniel Orr's Turkish salad. A report estimates there's been an 81% decline in the monarch butterfly population in the Midwest between 1999 and 2010. We'll hear about the efforts to save the butterflies. And then Shop Like a Chef with Clara Moore. A news update with Mark Chilla, first up.
We learned this week that the number of people newly diagnosed with diabetes is in its fifth straight year of decline. That's after decades of an increasing number of cases. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 1.4 million people were diagnosed with diabetes in 2014, down from 1.7 million new cases in 2009. The EPA is seeking to pull a recently approved herbicide from the market. Harvest Public Media's Abby Wendell reports.
The request comes after the EPA received new information from the herbicide manufacturer, Dow AgroSciences. It suggests that Enlist Duo could be more toxic than the agency previously thought.
It's good for weed control because it actually makes the weeds die better.
Dean Rikers is a weed scientist at the University of Illinois.
But it could have the same effect if it lands on somebody's vineyard. You know, I guess that's what the EPA wants to find out.
The agency currently requires farmers who use the herbicide to leave a 30-foot buffer around areas where they spray to protect endangered plant species and sensitive crops. In light of the new information, the agency said the buffer zone could change. Dow is confident it will be able to work with the EPA to keep Enlist Duo on the market. Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media.
After a year-long investigation of its own practices, Nestle announced that some of its products contain seafood produced by migrant workers in Thailand who are forced to work in unthinkable conditions. The report was conducted by labor rights organization Verite. Many of Thailand's migrant seafood workers are illegally trafficked from Myanmar and Cambodia, often lured with false promises and charged exorbitant fees to keep them in debt as they flee persecution and poverty at home. Nestle executive Magdi Batato announced plans to clean up its supply chain and ramp up self-policing. Nestle is facing two lawsuits from a U.S. law firm, including one connected to the Thai fishing industry and another for charges that the company, along with food giants ADM and Cargill, aided child slavery to pick cocoa beans in Cote d'Ivoire. And NPR's Dan Charles takes a look at how big food companies like Mars, Nestle, and General Mills are speaking out about climate change. Take a look at that online at eartheats.org.
Along with our news bloggers, Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie, that is Mark Chilla.
Thanks, Annie.
The behemoth seed company Monsanto transformed U.S. agriculture when it introduced a soybean seed that could withstand the company's herbicide. 20 years later, the patent for that technology has expired. That opened the door for universities to create their own genetically modified seeds based on the popular variety. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports.
90% of soybean seeds in the U.S. are genetically engineered to withstand herbicides. Often, that's glyphosate, the weed-whacking ingredient in Roundup. They're called Roundup Ready. When the patent expired this year on the first generation of Roundup Ready soybeans, university researchers saw an opportunity. Researchers like Andrew Skabu at the University of Missouri.
A research plot could be anything from one plant to hundreds of thousands of plants in eight rows, hundreds of feet long, and everything in between.
Today, he's checking a test plot in the 50 acres of research fields at the Bay Farm Research Facility just outside of Columbia, Missouri. The plants here have the Roundup Ready trait. That means farmers can spray entire fields with Roundup herbicide without damaging their precious soybeans.
This plot is plot 123 out of thousands of plots that we have out here.
Monsanto is pushing new generations of seeds, but the original Roundup Ready trait is still valuable to farmers. Researchers like Skaboo want to take the original technology and add layers of protection against other pests. To do that, he's breeding soybean plants that can survive diseases while maintaining high yield numbers. And then?
Then we can incorporate the Roundup Ready 1 technology in just a few years into that same variety through backcrossing. And that's because the Roundup Ready 1 technology is controlled by one gene.
Imagine the fancy multivitamin you buy at the store going generic. Then your local university takes the pill and adds in an extra vitamin that's particularly important for people that live in your region. The University of Missouri soybean seeds guard against nematodes, sudden death syndrome, and frog eye leaf spots. Iowa researchers might target different soybean diseases specific to their state. Same for Nebraska, Illinois, and so on. But will farmers take a risk and buy these off-brand seeds?
It remains to be seen.
Nancy Parker licenses new plant science technologies at the University of Missouri.
I think most farmers, the first thing they look for is, does the product yield? If it happens to have a trait in it that they like and it's an advantage for them, that's great.
While under patent, Roundup Ready seeds ran between $55 and $70 a bag, according to Randy Baker, a seed salesman in Northeast Missouri. But these university-developed seeds are generic versions, so they're generally cheaper. University of Arkansas's versions are going for less than half the original price. This is the perfect time for generics, Baker says. With low returns on commodity prices the past 2 years, farmers are looking to cut input costs. Baker says he sold out of Roundup Ready 1 last year and had customers calling as early as August asking about prices for 2016.
I've never saw that before, but there was a lot of them. In fact, we got our pricing earlier than we've ever had it before. They're very rigorously looking and searching for ways to cut farm expense.
As older seeds come off patent, farmers do have concerns that the original pesticide technology may not be as effective against weeds that build up resistance, so-called superweeds that are difficult and costly to kill. Andrew Skaboo says that's why researchers are looking into developing seeds compatible with multiple weed killers.
The days of having a variety that only has one mode of action for herbicide use for resistance to herbicide are probably gone in the next 5 years.
Skaboo says as weed threats continue to evolve, farmers' tools do too. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Later on today, from Harvest, how changes to the landscape and plant life in both the U.S. and Mexico have impacted the monarch butterfly population. What if really great cooks toured the country like musicians do? And then what if they gave their performances in your dining rooms? Today, we meet someone who's doing just that.
Welcome.
Thanks.
You guys are ready for a party.
Yeah.
Hopefully people are coming.
Eric Ayat and Charlie Jones are throwing a dinner party for their friends at their house in Bloomington. Ayat moved all the chairs and the couch and the TV out of the way.
We are in our living room that we've now kind of changed and formed into a little cafe. So we have three tables and a bunch of chairs set up, trying to give as much of an authentic cafe feel as we possibly can here at our house.
They're anticipating about 25 guests today, although they opened up the invitation to friends of friends, so who knows how many people could show up. It's about 1 hour before people should start filing in. At this point, most dinner party hosts would be frantic with last-minute preparations. But Eric and Charlie are calm. They're chill. That roasted vegetable casserole that's filling the space with some amazing smells, well, they had nothing to do with it. Jones says this is one of the easiest dinner parties she's ever had to throw.
Yeah, that's quite accurate, actually. We get to host people, make people feel welcome, but we don't have to do any of the cooking. That's nice. I didn't really think of it that way. We got a wonderful chef here to cook all the food.
The chef is a soft-spoken guy who's mopping his sweaty brow and breathing a sigh of relief after a long day of cooking.
Yeah, you gotta come in here first.
Oh.
I'm hiding things in here.
We're in the laundry room, by the way, where I like to hide things.
Joshua Plug has scattered the six courses for his vegan feast all over the house.
There's ample space here, but if I'm plating two, then I have to put things in cubby holes.
You have to get creative. We're literally on top of the dryer now.
Dryer.
What is going on?
Oh, that's my dessert.
Oh, which... so we'll be back. Okay. We'll come back.
Yeah, he'll describe the food in a second. Ask Plug where he's from, and he's not really sure how to answer. He's been traveling the country for much of the past couple years, and that suits him just fine. He started off as a musician, traveling from basement show to basement show with several different punk bands. Occasionally, he would make food at the shows or do a cooking demonstration. Eventually, he got enough positive feedback that he compiled his own cookbook. He then tapped into his existing contacts in the DIY music scene to jumpstart his idea of a traveling pop-up cafe.
And the tour model is absolutely from playing in punk bands, and I just decided that it was a great idea to use that model to cook. And it actually works better for cooking than it does for playing music, because I make more money, it's just me, I can stay in a town, and your band's not going to play 7 shows in Minneapolis, but I can cook 7 dinners without much trouble there.
And he's been cooking in other people's kitchens for the past 10 years. This isn't a money-making venture for Plug. Visitors are encouraged to pay a donation, which goes toward groceries and his travel expenses.
Kalamata olives. Had to look.
But back to the food.
And the soup is like a minestrone, but it's lima bean based, because I really like lima beans and butter beans, and people don't really use them enough, so they're in there. And a gluten-free pasta. It's like a roasted pepper, tomato, and paprika broth with cinnamon, so it's hearty and it's tasteful. And then onto the fridge, here we've got a pineapple Caesar. It'll refresh people in between that and the main dish, which is this. It's like a roasted vegetable tureen. So
open in the oven.
Yeah, it's like got crispy potatoes on top and soft potatoes and rutabaga on the bottom, and a layer of spinach and onions and roasted eggplant. And we have a side of a black-eyed pea coleslaw with purple cabbage. And a cider vinaigrette, scallion, and cilantro. And this little rice pilaf with white asparagus and Italian parsley.
Now, back to the laundry room.
Oh, yeah. My little... You know what this is? It's a brownie shortbread.
In case you missed that, the dessert course is a brownie shortbread with fruit compote.
You know. You know.
Well, so did you see eggplant and... red cabbage, and you're like, okay, so now I'm starting to get a vision.
That's totally. I did the way that I normally come up with recipes, which is I walk into a space and see ingredients and then start thinking in my head all the different things I could do with it. And then I write notes in line as we're checking out and everything's going by the conveyor belt, which is fun because then usually the checker's looking at me funny. Then I explain the whole secret cafe idea or whatever, like the traveling paid dinner party idea, and they're amazed.
The hosts of the party are equally amazed. Jones went shopping with him this morning, so she knew what components he purchased. But she couldn't sketch out the menu on the chalkboard in the living room until just a few minutes ago, when the dishes were basically complete.
I don't even know if Joshua knew what he was cooking. He just goes for it. I was surprised at how spontaneous he is about the whole thing. But that adds to the excitement, so I'm even more intrigued as to what we're going to be eating now.
Welcome.
Take a seat wherever you like.
Limited plates, so we're starting the appetizers off with some napkins, if that's all right. But you're welcome to dig into those.
Plug plates up the first course of his Mediterranean meets Californian vegan Hoosier feast. That's what he's calling it.
It's certainly a treat because usually I always cook at home.
The appetizers are out.
The quinoa dolmates and mixed nut and dill pesto stuffed mushrooms. I've never tried a dolmate, so I don't know what one tastes like.
Okay. Mm. My first impression is floral. It's really yummy.
They are really good.
Oh my goodness. What's in here?
I mean, veganism gets a reputation for being exclusive, but really, barring allergies, anybody can eat it, and it should be very welcoming, so that's my attitude about it.
Joshua Plug cooked that living room dinner party in Bloomington, Indiana last year. Most recently, he was in the D.C., Providence, Philadelphia region. You can keep track of his schedule at joshuaplug.blogspot.com. Plug is spelled P-L-O-E-G. And his cookbook is This Ain't No Picnic, Your Punk Rock Vegan Cookbook. Coming up, chef and cookbook author Clara Moore says when she has to make a choice between organic or local chicken, she'll pick organic.
Because I feel like there's a lot more life and a lot more things packed into protein and meat. Vegetables, I find, should more be local.
Find out why. Up next. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Here we are again, Earth Eats at Farm Bloomington. Today we're going to do a real simple salad, but it's one of those things that you can use in a lot of different recipes.
Daniel Orr has cooked in France, in the Caribbean, in New York City. He brings that eclectic food life to his work now in Indiana. Let's see what he has for us today.
The recipe is called pia pizzaz, which is a Turkish onion salad. So we've got some red onions, a small red onion, sliced up super, super thin, paper thin. You want that. That's a very important part of the dish. Then I'm going to take a serrano chili, which is a medium heat chili, and a little bit in between kind of a jalapeno and something that's a little more aggressive. And I've sliced that again super thin. I'm going to leave that in nice rounds. Then we're going to add some mint. I'm just going to pick off those leaves off the stems, and we're going to rough chop that. We want it in kind of big pieces because we want to have that kind of punchy flavor. We don't want it just to dissolve into the salad. We'll add some rough chopped Italian parsley, about a half a cup. All right, and then our fresh lemon juice, about a half to a whole lemon, depending on the size of the lemon. And then finally some olive oil. I'm going to toss that together. Got a pita bread back here that I've got toasting. It's nice and steamy. Okay, and then whatever you want to put in there. Today I've got some of those nice little baby cucumbers, and we're just going to cut some slices of that. I'm going to crumble that goat cheese in there. Then we'll put some of that nice piaz pizzaz on top. Decorate it with some heirloom tomatoes. Garnish with some frise salad. And there you've got a really nice, simple lunch. Maybe we'll throw some olives around there. And we've got a wonderful, light, vegetarian lunch.
Recipes, photos, tips, and tricks at eartheats.org. Clara Moore made a name for herself in the St. Louis food scene when she worked as executive chef at the local Harvest Cafe. A couple years ago, she picked up and moved to the Pacific Northwest, which resulted in what she called food culture shock. She had to learn about the growing season, which was much shorter than what she was used to in Missouri, and fresh seafood. That was new. Her technique for getting to know a new place is to go shopping at the local co-ops and mom-and-pop corner stores and ethnic markets. She talks to people and engages with the food system firsthand.
Not just go to the store like a robot, take the food off the shelves, go through the line, and then go home and unpack it. It's really much more than that. Your butcher knows so much about meat. Ask them what is good today. Ask them what they recommend. Ask them if there's a cheaper cut that you could use. And then the same with the farmers. Or also ask your farmer if they have an excess of something that they might want to let go for a deal. Farmers are business people, and they definitely want to move their product. So whatever they can do to move their product, they're happy with.
Her first cookbook is called Shop Like a Chef, So I asked her for tips the rest of us should keep in mind when we hit the grocery store. First thing she recommends is to buy food more than just once a week.
That's something I would recommend to anyone, anywhere, all the time, especially if you are really interested in seasonal and local, really understanding the diversity of what you can get. The more often you shop, the more you see things changing, and the more you see new stuff, and the more you can be inspired.
Relive your days working at Local Harvest in St. Louis. You're shopping for the ingredients for that day. Do you make a list, or you just sort of go to the store and see how the spirit moves you?
I would say half and half. So I like to have kind of a general idea. This is for home and for work, honestly. I like to have a general idea of what I may want to eat that week or in the next few days. And then kind of leave them open-ended, like, you know, I'd like to eat chicken. So I pick my protein, and then I go and see what I can mix with that. What's going to be at the store that's going to inspire me or that's going to look so beautiful I can't not pick it up?
So let's say you're going to make a gorgeous chicken, pasta, zucchini meal. What is an absolute must? Which ingredient must be local, which must be organic, and which can you sort of play with?
That is a lot of like a minefield. That's a minefield of a question.
Purposely.
Right. So I would say if it's going to be organic, I tend towards meat, my meats being organic, because I feel like there's a lot more life and a lot more things packed into proteins and meat. Vegetables, I find, should more be local because they're just going to taste better. You know, you can freeze an organic chicken in Washington and send it to Missouri, and it's going to taste basically relatively the same. But you can't pick a zucchini in a field in Washington and then fly it to St. Louis and think it's going to taste as good.
Then I'm also wondering, now that you've moved out there, you're cooking more at home than you ever had at any point in your life. Mm-hmm. Have you learned anything from that? Is there anything you've picked up from just having to do it all the time?
Yes, I have. First of all, I use my freezer a lot. I'll make like a lot of rice, and then I freeze the rice. And frozen rice is surprisingly versatile, and you can use it for lots of stuff. Breaking down chicken and then freezing it, breaking down meat and then freezing it. So when you buy in bigger quantities and cook in bigger quantities, you're saving yourself money and time.
She's also now planning ahead with her cooking, preparing meals for the week on Sunday. All in all, she's thoughtful about where she shops, how often, and what she takes home with her. Moore says this gives her food depth.
It really is about more than just going and buying your food and taking it home. It really is about your community. It's about economically your community, but also socially. And that is an extremely important thing. It's not just always about nutrients.
Clara Moore is the author of Shop Like a Chef, A Food Lover's Guide to St. Louis Neighborhoods. Lots of great insider information with recipes and a glossary of food terms. She now lives in Maine. Find some of the recipes she contributes to our website at eartheats.org. The population of monarch butterflies has declined so dramatically in recent years that the iconic insect is being considered for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Endangered Species List. Scientists and others throughout the Midwest are studying the problem. For Harvest Public Media, Mike Tobias reports on the examinations into the scope of the decline in Nebraska and efforts to bring back monarch habitats.
It seems to all be on that side.
Carrying notebook and camera, Tom Weisling wades through waist-high grass and plants at Nine Mile Prairie west of Lincoln. The associate professor in the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's Department of Entomology periodically stops, looks closely at plants, and takes notes and pictures. It's how he spent a lot of his summer combing the state for signs of something that's getting harder to find, monarch butterflies.
Mostly I'm trying to find monarch larvae. In my last trip, I looked at several hundred plants and I only found about four larvae.
He's also looking for milkweed. The connection is important because monarchs lay their eggs exclusively on milkweed, and it's the only thing the larva will eat.
This is called world milkweed.
Weisling's rough survey took him to about two-thirds of Nebraska's counties and is something of a starting point in determining the decline of monarchs in Nebraska. It's not a pretty picture. An Iowa State University report estimated an 81% decline in monarch production in the Midwest between 1999 and 2010, with a 58% decline in milkweed presence during the same time.
Less milkweed will equal fewer monarchs overall and fewer of these other insects that we're seeing on milkweeds, and I don't think that's something we want to experience.
Why this is happening can be controversial. Some say milkweed loss is caused by increased use of agricultural herbicides. Others say monarch decline is also the result of forest land loss in Mexico, where monarchs winter, and temperature fluctuations. Duane Havorka is executive director of the Nebraska Wildlife Federation.
That's what's happened over the last 20 years, is we've seen big changes in the landscape, loss of native prairies, big changes in ag production technologies.
Regardless of the cause, Havorka says these are big changes that require big responses, especially in Midwestern states that are a key for monarch migration.
To bring together a broader group of folks to try to see if...
Researchers and environmental advocates gathered in a Lincoln meeting room earlier this fall, a half dozen people with an interest in reviving monarch populations. They're looking at developing a statewide conservation plan and its strategies for increasing milkweed.
We think we can do that by planting seeds and live plants on public lands, parks and wildlife management areas, on some of the conservation lands that are owned by places like the Audubon Society and the Crane Trust and the Nature Conservancy. We'd also like to see some different management along county and state roads. Right now, we do a lot of mowing in places and at times we don't need to, and so that takes out the milkweed populations.
Weisling says they could also work on convincing businesses and homeowners to embrace milkweed as an addition to their landscaping and just think differently about where milkweed could be allowed to grow.
My approach would be you don't have to get rid of all of it. Maybe think of areas that are marginal for crops or areas that you don't put in any crop production that maybe you could grow some milkweeds on.
And it could take a lot of milkweed to reverse the trend. Havorka says the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is talking about a 5-year goal of having scattered milkweed presence on 7 million acres nationally, primarily in the Great Plains. He says a million of that could be in Nebraska. Nebraska Game and Parks has already started doing some of this work, planting milkweed along a recreational trail.
Ah, looky there. Look what we found.
Back at Nine Mile Prairie, Weisling flips over a milkweed leaf to expose a yellow and black striped monarch caterpillar. He found 14 of these during his statewide summer survey, but says the statistics are more starting point than barometer at this stage. Just another part of an effort Weisling hopes will save what he calls the bald eagle of American insects. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Mike Tobias.
We share stories from the Harvest Public Media Reporter Collective on our show. If you haven't visited their website yet, do take a moment today to check it out. It's harvestpublicmedia.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. So good to have been with you today. Have a wonderful week. I'm Annie Corrigan.